These guys have earnings coming up next week.
And you got the labor. I mean, the labor here is tremendous. I mean, we got a
15.3% is the number, which is alarming. Even more alarming, I think, is that the number...
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And here we are in the Allstate Skyline studio. Welcome to this Tuesday afternoon, 12:13 on this Tuesday. Yeah, we got a lot to talk about. As I said earlier, it's unusual, but we're going to have novelist Rebecca Mackay come on. I used to interview a lot of authors, and Rebecca's from Chicago. I want to talk to her about the business of selling books, but she's been all over the place. She's got a great novel out right now called The Great Believers. So Rebecca coming up a little bit after the headlines at the bottom of the hour. Lou Manfredini will be here as well. But we start on Tuesdays with John Najarian. I was just watching him on CNBC on the Halftime Report. He dumps his microphone for TV, picks up a telephone and calls us. John, welcome back to the Biz Lunch. And we just lost him. He must have just dumped out. I don't know what happened there. But John does the Halftime Report with his brother Jeff and others on CNBC. I think one of the things we're going to be talking about today is Turkey. There was this scare over the lira that seems to have calmed a little bit. Wall Street is reacting to that. Oh, another thing. In the second half hour, do you have a kid with a tattoo, or maybe you're tatted up? Do you tell them that that's going to hurt them when it comes to finding a job? Turns out that's not really the case. They've been studying it with some HR professionals, and they say that having a tattoo not only doesn't necessarily hurt you, it can actually help you in some cases when it comes to finding a job. So we will talk with the Chicago Tribune reporter who covered that story a little bit later after the news headlines. We're standing by now for John Najarian. We had the phone line there, and we lost him just for a second. John from CNBC, the earnings numbers were out today. Advance Auto Parts did well. I want to ask him about Tesla as well. John, welcome back to the Biz Lunch again. How are you?
Hey, I'm very well. Just a little bit of a technical glitch.
No problem. I was just saying, I saw you on TV there. Throw off your telephone, pick up your telephone, give us a call. All right, it's all about Turkey today, right? Is that what we're looking at?
Well, more yesterday was all about Turkey. Today it was more or less the world deciding that Turkey wasn't going to be the catalyst for another contagion. At least that's the thinking so far today. And, of course, some pretty decent earnings out of some companies that are driving those stocks higher. That didn't hurt either, Stephen.
We're talking about Home Depot here, or who else?
Yeah, Home Depot in particular, although it did give back a lot of that early gain. It was up as much as $5, but big turnaround over with Tapestry, which is the former Coach. COH and that, used to be the symbol. Now it's TPR.
And that Tapestry. That's the Kate Spade brand, correct?
Right, and they're saying a big recovery in Kate Spade. No one's trying to profit off of course, right, the tragedy over there, but it did put her top of mind, and it probably made a lot of her wares even more attractive to collectors that worried that she might not be the influence going forward that she was, much like Enzo Ferrari. People collect those cars because he was the one designing those, and when you switch over to a new manufacturer, a new leader, it's a little different.
And what's up with Tesla now in Saudi? I think last Tuesday, what we talked about, maybe an investment from the Saudis. They're still talking about it. They're investigating it. What's going on there?
Well, Tesla does already have a fair amount of Saudi wealth in it. And, of course, Mr. Musk is saying, I'm talking with them about a bigger investment with us, along with Goldman Sachs and Silver Lake. It's not quite the same as the bluster that he had last week when he said he had it all lined up. That's not the exact phrase that he used, but he said he more or less had it fully funded at $420 a share. Now, the different thing here, Steve, might be that he's not necessarily saying you have to sell it to me or to whoever the buyers are.
Right.
Apparently, he wants a lot of people to decide they just want to own this as a private company. But that has a whole bunch of issues, given that it started off as a public company, and a lot of people that own it as a public company perhaps might not qualify to own it as a private company, since there are different hurdles for that.
So it'd be the Green Bay Packers of the auto industry?
That's what it might be. There certainly are a lot of believers in what, and I'm one of them, in what Mr. Musk's magic is.
Right.
I'd say he probably is second only to Steven Jobs in terms of vision and creativity. I mean, X.com, SpaceX, as well as Tesla, you know, and PayPal. These are some of the companies that he's been at the center of founding or certainly leading.
We've talked about that. We've kind of talked about that creative or quirky genius, you know, that there are two sides to that coin. I think he shows that.
All right, he certainly does.
What's your tip for us today? What are you watching?
One of the more interesting plays was Constellation Brands. The symbol is STZ, like Sierra Tango Zebra. Mm-hmm. And the reason we liked that one was, obviously, they sell a lot of what I enjoy and a lot of Americans and people around the world enjoy, beer, wine, and spirits. They have a minor investment in cannabis as well. And I think that a stock that has not performed as well, perhaps because of some of that international exposure, is due to outperform. And we were buying it for ourselves and customers today.
All right. There it is, John Najarian. Thanks very much for joining us. I appreciate it. Follow John on Twitter at John Najarian. Also, of course, at the Najarian Family Office. It is now 12:23. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. All right, I'm driving around a couple of Saturdays ago, and I'm listening to House Smarts Radio with Lou Manfredini, and I hear him talking about, well, baseball, and then Sloan Valve Company, because you were obsessed with the what was on the doors at Wrigley Field, right? The outfield doors.
Well, I was at the ballpark and with my father-in-law, my son, and two of my nephews.
Right.
And I knew that we have this broadcast coming up where we're going to be at the Cubby Bear, not this Saturday, but the following Saturday. All are welcome to come. And in particular, if you're a plumber, you can come to this as well.
How about if you're the president and CEO of
I hope that he's going to be there.
Jim Allen's on a phone line. Jim, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hey, guys.
How are you?
Well, thank you. Doing great. How are you guys today?
Well, thanks. So, all right, so tell us a little bit. You know, Sloan is one of those names that's out there that we all know we know, but we probably don't, right? Chicago company goes back 100 years. Tell me about Sloan and the flushometer.
Yeah, the flushometer. My great-grandfather invented the Royal Flushometer in 1906 in Chicago.
That's awesome.
And I represent the fourth generation of ownership of the company.
So in 1906, now I grew up in, you know,
1907.
I grew up in farm country. Where, I mean, they were still functioning outhouses that I was aware of in the 60s and the 70s. In 1906, how widespread was indoor plumbing?
Yeah, and Lou will know this because what he was actually inventing was replacing those big old tanks that be hung up on the wall. He had a pole chain.
The Godfather tank.
Yeah, you could, good for stashing guns, but it wasted a lot of water and was dangerous to work on. So what he thought was, you know, we got line pressure coming to the building. Why don't we just use the line pressure to function the fixture and save a lot of water? Wow. And so from the very beginning, my great-grandfather was a water efficiency sort of minded person, and Sloan has been that way for 112 years.
You know, that's what I wanted to ask you about, because I wondered that very thing about when conservation kicked in this industry, or if it always existed. I would imagine the pressure is greater now than it's ever been, but you're saying that water conservation kind of was always in the back of your mind.
Yeah, and if you look back at old Sloan ads from the 20s and 30s, they were all talking about saving water and you're exactly right. It's much more top of mind these days with the green building movement and sustainability and the U.S. Green Building Council's LEED product that certifies green buildings. So there's a huge focus on energy conservation, water conservation, and that's really our sweet spot. And we went, you know, the name of the business is Sloan Valve Company, but we started taking the valve off the end because we make faucets and all kinds of other things now,
right?
Well, besides just valves.
And Jim, I mean, the thing is, yeah, certainly all those certifications that you talk about are so important. But at the end of the day, if you're going to put all of your products in a hotel that's being built or a hospital or a new airport, for instance, you know, I mean, it's funny. I travel to New York all the time. They're building, you know, LaGuardia Airport is in the middle of this gigantic renovation. And if you're the Sloan company, you want to be part of that project. The cost of water to produce it, not only just to be environmentally conscious of it, but it's a huge number. And this valve that your great-grandfather invented is so innocuous in everyday life. I mean, both, you know, in a male restroom or a female restroom, it doesn't matter, or a multi-gender family restroom, whatever it may be. But yeah, you guys have expanded quite a bit. And one of the things that for me, of course, I notice these things. The design of what you're making is a lot nicer too and sharper. So now people are going into some of these cool bathrooms in a restaurant, and you might have some of your sinks and products in there that people are like, wow, that's kind of cool looking.
Right. Everybody wants something now that is sleek and elegant like an iPhone, but you can hammer nails with it.
Well, you know,
so we are.
I'm sorry,
Jim. I'm just trying to produce a product that has a nice design, but like Lou was saying, a functionality that gets the building the plumbing system is operating, you know, efficiently, and the users like the product too.
Well, here's the thing: when I think sleek and elegant, I think of Lou Manfredini, and so everyone will have a chance to see him coming up in a couple of Saturdays.
Yeah,
right?
August 25th, we're going to be at the Cubby Bear on from 7 to 10 a.m. It's free to attend. All guests, if you'd like, can register at WGNradio.com, but you can just show up as well. Come one, come all. The first 50 listeners, Steve, in attendance are going to receive a goodie bag courtesy of Sloan, and there'll be a light continental breakfast, including fruit pastries. And wait, it gets better. We named a sandwich. The Sloan Royal Breakfast Sandwich.
Jim Sloan, the CEO of Sloan Valley. Jim, it was great to talk to you. Thanks very much. Good luck on a couple Saturdays.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot. Have a great day.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. Lou Manfredini, thank you as well.
My pleasure.
I've been a guest on your show so many times, I don't think you've ever...
Really a pleasure to be here at WGN Radio. It's been a dream of mine.
Good luck, and maybe one day you'll be back.
Okay.
Thanks, Ryan Burrow. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, here on 720 WGN. All right, this is kind of a break in form for me. I don't usually talk to authors these days, not nearly as much as I used to, but if you paid any attention to the world of books in the past few months, you almost certainly have come across the name Rebecca Mackay. Her novel, The Great Believers, has landed her everywhere from the local library and newspapers to the Seth Meyers show, the late night show. And now, well, this probably is the biggest for her of all.
She's definitely
in the studio for the Wintrust Business Lunch. Rebecca, it's great to see you again. Welcome.
Great to see you. Thanks.
So, you know, Chicago writer, North Shore writer, how do you describe yourself?
I would call myself a Chicago writer. I live in the suburbs,
right.
But there are different ways of living in the suburbs. I'm here all the time.
I might have. I think I've read all your books: The Borrowers, The 100 Year House. There was a
Music for Wartime was my story
collection. Story, right?
Yeah.
And now The Great Believers. This is getting the most play, right? How do you feel about that?
It is getting the most play. I think rightly so. I think it's my best book. You're not supposed to, you know, they're not children. You're allowed to love one more than the other.
Right.
So I can just say it's my best book.
Remember the guy, who's the guy? Remember the name? The guy who wrote Snow Falling on Cedars. I can't think of his name.
Oh, I'm going to blank too.
I know. It's insulting to say that. But he told me once, he goes, no, I believe the next book I write is always the best book.
Has to. Yeah. Otherwise, you'd stop. No one's going to be like, yeah, I'm going to write my third best book now.
Well,
so
I guess
that's my
true.
Plan.
It wouldn't work out that well. The Great Believers has to do with the AIDS crisis in large part. And not in San Francisco or in New York, but here in Chicago. And I was struck by your research that said there really hasn't been much written about Chicago.
Not that much. You know, in terms of actual full-length, you know, books, in terms of movies, documentaries, even stories depicted fictionally, it's almost always about New York or San Francisco. There's
right.
so little. There's some great journalism that's done. Certainly, I was able to find articles. I was able to find a few memoirish type things. But I went in thinking at least there would be the one big nonfiction book about the history of AIDS in America's third largest city. Zip.
And so here's the most moving thing maybe for me. I told you this via Twitter. I was in Mexico on a trip helping out with a charity, and I had an advanced copy of the book, and I'm reading it. And in my group of, I think there were probably 15 or 20 of us, there were three or four young gay men, maybe early 30s or late 20s. And I'm reading this book about this AIDS crisis that I witnessed and lived through in some ways. And I'm looking at these guys who are having the time of their life, you know, at the karaoke bar and all that. And I'm thinking they probably don't have an idea of what their forebearers, is that the right,
sure.
kind of what they went through. So I took the book, I finished it, and gave it to one of them, and I hope they've been handing it around. Was that in your mind at all, sort of not an education, but an information sort of
You know,
approach?
Yeah, I think I was writing for two different audiences simultaneously. One being people who do not know about the AIDS crisis or the AIDS crisis in Chicago don't know these details, whether it's because they are very young or because they were around but maybe not in a major city, right, or they were around and they were oblivious. And then the other group that I'm writing for is people who know this intimately. I wanted to get everything right on the detail level so that these people...
What's a woman from the north suburbs writing about gay guys in the AIDS crisis in the 80s doing?
Right.
Did you have that fear?
Absolutely. No, it was a very healthy fear. I ask myself that constantly. And we talk a lot in the arts about appropriation, about this question of, am I being vampiric in some way, right?
Right.
Ultimately, you know, I felt, first of all, like I could do it well if I did loads of research, which I did, first-person research mostly. And then I also felt like, you know, ultimately my question is, you know, is publishing this going to mute more direct first-person accounts of this?
Stifle someone else from writing.
Right, or could it amplify those? And ultimately my answer was the latter. Partly, you know, this is Business Lunch, so we'll say, you know, a publishing house is so much more likely, if my book is successful,
to
put money behind a book next year, 2 years from now, on similar topics from an LGBTQ voice.
One of the things you did is you brought us inside Illinois Masonic Hospital to this ward dedicated to AIDS patients.
Yeah.
I didn't know it existed. And the doctors are still around. You talked to them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Dr. David Moore and Dr. David Blatt, they are married now, you know, life partners. And they founded this dedicated AIDS care unit together, one of the first like that in the world, and became the model for compassionate AIDS care.
It's my favorite book of the year, easily.
Aww,
and in part because, you know, you write about the streets I walked on, you know, the Unabridged bookstore, great spot, go visit it today.
Yeah.
And all of that. So I enjoyed it so much. The Great Believers, it's called. A couple other questions. I read somewhere that you have a Facebook page, a private Facebook page for authors.
Yeah.
And you talk about strategy or appearances.
It's about money.
No,
it's private. So
it's a business lunch, so.
Yeah, no. I think I really would encourage anyone in any kind of, especially in the arts, to do this with a group of trusted friends who are in your industry. Because in writing, you know, we don't tend to talk about money. You get an advance, you keep it secret.
Right.
What a university says, what's your fee? And you kind of make something up and you don't know what other people are doing. And I think especially for women, we aren't taught to negotiate. We undercut ourselves constantly.
So have you learned from this page?
Very much.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, because I'll say, gosh, this university offered me this. Could I ask for a couple hundred more dollars? And I have people coming in saying, no, ask for $1,000 more.
Right.
Do this. Here's how you phrase it. And I need that constantly. And I can give advice to people as well.
We're talking about stigma here. There's another one, right? Talking about money.
Yeah.
Okay, there's another question. So I am a fan of Charles Finch. Why
okay.
are you laughing?
Oh, no, I'm not. Sorry. Yeah.
And you write a lot about with him. You tweet back and forth with him. And so this might be an unfair question. You're in the business of selling books. You want to get people to like you, right?
Okay. Yeah, theoretically.
But your tweets you have very political tweets, very opinionated tweets. And I just wonder if you think about that, if this is going to help me sell a book or hurt me sell a book, or is that in the filter? I'll give you what I think your answer will be after you give me what your answer.
Okay, sure. And you're talking about another author there who also tweets very politically.
Right, right.
And I think there are plenty of us doing that. That's just another Chicago author. First of all, I don't care.
Right.
I'm not gonna censor myself, to sell more books. Secondly, you know, I have very liberal political views. And at the risk of, you know, again, I'll say something very political here, not really worrying about it. Most readers of literary fiction have views that you could consider liberal at least in the loosest definition of
sure.
the word,
okay.
open to many. Points of view.
You.
You know, I think that people who would be easily offended by someone's point of view are probably not the readers of literary fiction.
Well, here's my answer for you, because I really have been thinking of you. I've been thinking of you guys when I see this. And I guess the other answer is, as an artist, you need to speak up. If you're quiet in your opinions, there's little value in that.
Yeah, no. My grandmother was a novelist in Hungary during coming out of World War II and then going into the communist regime. She was literally smuggling her books out of the country to get them safe so they could be published after her death. She was writing historical fiction to hide the fact that she was writing politically. So, you know, I look at certainly things are different now than they were maybe 5 years ago in that regard. But I would never bat an eye at what artists need to do to speak their mind and to be political.
That's Rebecca Mackay. The name of the book, go check it out, The Great Believers. Thanks. Nice to come. Thanks for coming. I'm befuddled. Thanks for coming by. It's great to see you. Yeah, I'm a big fan. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Steve.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. We all know the tech industry is a booming space, so as a result, it can get pretty competitive. And the perfect example is the Chicago company attracting former executives from Fortune 500 companies. Poster child Uptake attracted another bunch of GE executives to head their finance, customer success, portfolio strategy, and corporate development divisions at their company. When you have a mix of industry veterans like this and new brilliant Midwest minds coming from school, you're bound to see some results as expectations for innovation continue to climb. But the question we're all curious about, where will it leave the old guards? Adapt or be disrupted? I mean, that's what Aldi's doing. The German grocer's U.S.-based headquarters is in Batavia, Illinois, and they're putting in the work to help keep them ahead of the curve by reinvesting in themselves. They're in the midst of spending $5 billion on renovations, new locations, and adding a range of vegan and organic products. Trying to attract those Whole Foods customers. I see what you're doing there, Aldi. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thank you very much, Steve Alexander. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. And here we are on 720 WGN on this Tuesday afternoon. Okay, they looked at 2015, I think, the latest number. 30% of Americans had at least one tattoo in 2015. In 2011, that number was 20%. So more and more of us are getting tatted up. Nearly half of millennials are tattooed, compared with only 13% of baby boomers. So the question is, if you're considering a tattoo, is it bad for business or bad for employment? Alexia Alejalde Ruiz is on a phone line. She writes for the Chicago Tribune, and she posed that question and answered it in her story. Alexia, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, when I read your story, it brought me back quickly to a conversation I had. We were out to dinner with friends, and I was with an executive, and he was a little befuddled by the whole thing. I've used that word twice in a show. I can't do that again. But, he didn't understand it. He thought it was bad for business. He thought it was bad for hiring. But it turns out, if you look at the numbers, it might even be good.
So I wrote this story because a new study was just published in a journal by researchers from University of Miami that examined whether people who have tattoos experience any adverse employment outcomes. So they looked at whether they're employed any less frequently than people without tattoos, whether they work fewer hours, and if they earn any less. And what they found was that there's absolutely no difference, no matter where your tattoos are, how visible they are, how many you have. Even content of the tattoos didn't matter. So they're concluding that, as they become more popular, employers are kind of shrugging.
You know, it's funny because I wonder, Alexia, if they're becoming more, well, I guess they are becoming more popular, but maybe my question has to do with widely accepted. Are they becoming more widely accepted among baby boomers and those older than millennials, or is it just the fact that the millennials are flooding the world and they are becoming consensus opinion?
Yeah, I think that as millennials, take over leadership positions in companies, they're the ones who are making the hiring decisions. They're the ones who are setting the tone for culture. So because they're much more permissive about tattoos, that's influencing, just how employers are generally. I do think that it's very industry specific, and there are some companies that are still, helmed by people in the baby boomer or more conservative generations who might not look upon it so well. And then there are the more conservative industries like banking or legal and, lawyers, right, that might not want somebody with a neck tattoo in court.
but do you see where it could be coming to a point where a prospective boss might look askance at someone who's not tattooed?
I would be very surprised if somebody would be discriminated against for not having a tattoo. But I do think there might be some industries, maybe really creative industries, where it is kind of part of the culture that, you like to hire people who look like you and who look like other people around you. So there might be some cultures where that's valued, or because, tattoos these days aren't about, rebellion. They tell stories, generally, and so sometimes they can be a way to connect with people and to open up, and that might be helpful in the hiring process as well.
The other thing is if you are hiring or you're running a business and you have no tattoo or strict tattoo rule, you might be cheating yourself of talent these days.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, just if half of millennials have a tattoo, and granted, not all of those are visible, so you probably don't see them in the vast majority of job candidates, but if you just have a strict no tattoo policy, you're going to be limiting your talent pool and potentially opening yourself up to legal.
I think these numbers, too, if you look at this with the idea that the millennials are coming of age and moving into power, half of millennials feel, quote, extremely comfortable with a tattooed judge, compared with just 15% of people over 70. Alexia, would you be okay with a tattooed judge?
Absolutely. My mom's a judge. If she had a tattoo, I'd be thrilled.
Ah, no kidding. So that could have been the perfect example. Okay, so take me 10, 15 years into the future. Tattoo will be a majority feature on people and workers, or still a minority?
That's a great question. I do not have the crystal ball. I mean, you would think... these things are cyclical, right? So it's quite possible that young teenagers who see their millennial and Gen Xers parents all tattooed are going to be like, "That's the lamest thing ever. I'm not getting a tattoo." And so then it'll fall out of favor again. And so I don't know if it'll keep growing or if it's reaching its peak. You know, what I've read, it seems to suggest it's still going. That people are still getting inked. They're still getting inked in much more prominent places. And so I think we can continue to see more of it in the workforce, especially as people move away from their barista, coffee bar barista jobs, and then they take kind of more typical jobs, and so then you see them on the train heading downtown with everybody else, and they have a sleeve.
Alexia Alejalde Ruiz, thanks very much for joining us. I appreciate it. We'll read more from you in the Tribune.
Thank you so much.